Maybe the Belgian Reel 2. How did you cope with that suspension problem you're describing in detail?
My experience, of course, one knew where to look for impending trouble, like as indeed is the case in any similar profession where one is working with mechanical things. And so it was the good crew who knew from experience where trouble was likely to occur, and therefore checked every time the column stopped, and we had regular stops in those days, every hour I think it was, or less, even for a general check. Now, if that was done properly, a great deal of the troubles were avoided. I think that probably is the quick answer to your question.
What were they like to drive, those Carden Lloyds?
Going back to Carden Lloyds, well, it was just like driving an old-fashioned Ford car of the original era. Indeed, there was virtually no difference at all. You probably wouldn't remember, but the Ford had... its speed was determined by one of two levers underneath what was normally a steering wheel. Of course, we didn't have a steering wheel, kind of. And all those sort of details were exactly like an old-fashioned Ford, which was probably why it was chosen, because it was such a, under normal conditions, such a reliable piece of mechanism.
Did you find that you liked the section officer life? The routine?
How does one answer that question? We had a tremendous camaraderie, I think, generally speaking, but then I would think most regiments would boast that one. We had this rather special incentive to keep our vehicles going, and we were all interested in the whole problem of mechanical automobile engineering of those days. And on top of that, we had a rather special interest in our profession. I'm not suggesting the infantryman doesn't, but we had to keep these things moving. And perhaps all of this, if you think of it cumulatively, resulted in a rather special esprit de corps that we all had. And of course, this was enhanced later when we three of the then battalions, and I would be called regiments, were formed into the first experimental brigade.
You'd say that morale was good when you went to Lyd.
Very good indeed. Very good indeed.
You mentioned in the letter you sent me that you did occasional tactical exercises without troops. What was that?
This was normal in those days. In order to maintain the training of the officers and senior NCOs, and to some extent avoid the expense of taking a whole lot of equipment out into an acceptable area, and to some extent in order to avoid the necessity of finding a suitable area, tactical exercises without troops were normal. And there a scheme was set. The officers and NCOs were divided into syndicates, and they were invited to give their replies to questions that were set based on an overall exercise. This was a normal, particularly in the winter months, normal training system for tactics and things of this kind.
What were the sort of questions that were being asked then?
Well, if you like, you go out onto the ground and the directing staff, as it was called, usually the commanding officer and the adjutant, they would say, now, imagine your unit is here, imagine the enemy is there, imagine that the instructions are that they are to be driven out of their position, and etc., etc. How will you carry out this operation? And you would be told all the details, of course, of the equipment that you had, the artillery support that you could assume, and so on and so forth.
Was it generally based on tanks only, or...?
Was always based on armoured operations, oh yes. We did very little training with respect to the operation of the infantry. If we had any aspect of infantry tactics coming into what we were doing, it was more likely that the tactical exercise of our troops would be framed with an infantry unit alongside us, and we would do it together. And either we would be enemies, in which case they would give their way of how they were going to deal with our attack, or vice versa, or we would have a tutor in which there would be a plan devised for us both to act together.
Did they think about in terms of cavalry alongside you as well?
We had a cavalry regiment at Shawcliffe near us in where we were in Lydd. We never, that I recall, did any exercises in the sense of assuming that we were operating together or against one another. What we used to do was this, that occasionally we, the young officers from the tank regiment, were sent out for a day's exercise with the cavalry to learn how they operated and what they did. And such visits were reciprocated. They spent a day coming to see what the tanks were like, and riding on top of them, and so on and so forth, how they were drilling and so forth.
How did you enjoy that?
Well, we knew them all because we were in the same garrison, and naturally it was always a change and something out of the ordinary to be able to do that. One was also conscious that it was part of one's training to know how the other chap worked himself. How did a cavalry regiment operate? We could get on the radio set and say, advance. How did the cavalry officer tell his squadron to advance? We had a trumpeter, of course, and so on.
And you actually went to the cavalry and worked with them?
Spent, shall we say, a day exercise with them, yes. And they would come over to our place and spend the day with us. As a matter of fact, the Air Force came over once or twice as well.
Now, when the cavalry came to you, what did you do with them? Did you go out on exercise?
So they sat, as a rule, they were perched on top of the tanks for a short exercise so that they could see how the tanks were manoeuvred, how orders were given, and what sort of formations were adopted, and so on.
What do you think they thought of the tanks and tank corps?
Well, naturally, being cavalrymen, I think they found it a rather greasy sort of existence, being in a tank. But beyond that, I don't think anything particular stays in my mind about that.
Do you think this criticism that's always levelled at them, that they, you know, they resisted mechanisation, is that a valid sort of criticism?
I think it has to be said that at certain levels there was a criticism about this, that the tanks were would never be an efficient equipment in war for all sorts of reasons. It would break down for indigenous and home and so on and so forth. But how deep that criticism went is a difficult question to estimate. Let's put it this way, the older generation of the army of those days, which had been brought up with horses, quite naturally regarded the prospect of having to charge around the place in a tank with some misgiving. It wasn't really their idea of soldiering as they had understood it when they first joined the army, and I think this is understandable.
Did you, in your experience as a junior officer, meet hostility from cavalrymen about tanks?
I don't think hostility. I think quite probably they would, some would talk of that bunch of garage mechanics just as we would talk of them as that bunch of stable boys. It all ended up in, you know, in a sort of reasonably good spirit. I don't think there was anything very serious or to be worried about as far as the younger generation was concerned. When you get to the policy as to the future of armour and so on, there perhaps was the problem, the higher levels, and you will no doubt hear of this from people who were in that level, which I at this age certainly was not.
You mentioned earlier on about signals. You had wireless, did you?
Yes.
What exercises and work were you doing with wireless?
Well, as I said, there were three main subjects that everybody was instructed in, and wireless was one of them. And the wireless equipment we had, particularly the original type of equipment, before they got down to the smaller number three sets and so on that were in the Mark III light tanks, the sort of sets we had in the old Vickers Mark I and Mark II was the size of a 1 month's suitcase almost, and they were notoriously difficult to keep operational because they were the design of that period, the best that could be done, presumably, and so on. And you can imagine the type of wireless equipment that existed in those days put into a bumping tank was not calculated always to function as well as it normally was designed for. And it took a long time for the non-armoured trained people, put another way, when the cavalry were converted to tanks, it took a long time, I think, in some cavalry regiments for them to realise that without 99% good radio communications, the tank unit is might just as well go home. You can't handle the thing. It is the basis of the entire power of manoeuvre and power of command, and if the radio networks don't work and you've got to start waving your arms and flags and so forth, it's just as long.
Did you use flags, in fact, at Lyd?
Yes, we did. Partially because there were, in my early years, there was an insufficient number of sets available to have one in every tank. Only one in every section very often had one. And so naval type or flags designed on the naval type of pellets were used, and every tank carried a set of these. And with these you could say stop or go or turn right or follow me or whatever.
How effective was that?
As effective as one could make it, but quite obviously it meant the chap had got to lean out of his turret, and had it been in war, it would have been a very unpleasing way of having to do things.
Did the Signal Corps get involved at all with the wireless?
Not until the wireless sets were general, as eventually all tanks carried wireless sets, so every tank regiment had its own Royal Corps of Signals section as part of it, and their job was, so to speak, second line repairs and training.
But at LID, when you were there, there was no specialist?
No.
You were your own?
We were on our own. Mm.
And your techniques and things about it were based on what you'd learnt at Bovington, were they?
Yes. With subsequent instruction, of course, in barracks afterwards.
During the summer, you went down to exercises.
Mm-hmm.
What was your main function? What was your job? What was the objective you were doing?
You mean as a unit?
As a unit.
Well, one gets a bit mixed up with dates here, but as a matter of fact, the first year that I went down with my regiment, the third, all the three of the four then available tank regiments were there. Each had its own training area, and each was, in fact, employed on, first of all, squadron and then regimental training exercises, starting with simple manoeuvring, the line ahead, double line ahead, line, so on and so forth, and ending with battalion exercises when, if you like, one squadron would be allegedly pinning down the enemy and another squadron would come around here and attack him, and things of this kind. The second year we were formed, I hope I've got the years right, but it doesn't matter, I gave you all my letter. We did have a short time on Salisbury Plain to ourselves, and then one battalion was allocated to each of the infantry divisions, so that the infantry divisions of the British Army had an opportunity for a short period of exercises with tanks. The third of the 3 years that I took part in, whichever of the three it was the first year of the Experimental Army Brigade, the first in the world under General Sir Percy Hubbard. And that was when, and by this time they had built for the first time a proper command tank, which was a two-sub-turret affair, of which we can give you a picture. We've got one already.
Perhaps we can go back a bit to the 32 one. You went in July for these gunnery exercises. What did you do?
Well, part of this departure to that part of the world always was 3 to 4 weeks at Lullery, each battalion in turn for gunnery, because that was our main gunnery range. And so that was, so to speak, sandwiched in with going to or coming from Salisbury Plain.
What was, can you remember the details of that gunnery course?
Mm-hmm.
What were you doing?
Well, each, to begin with, each troop or section of them was carried out a chute. There was various types of chute on the ranges, and Bindon Hill is there just by Lulworth. We never were allowed to shoot a few exceptions, doesn't matter. But in principle, you were never allowed to shoot standing still. Now, the whole system of gunnery training in the tank regiment of those days was that the tank fired on the move. And the training was, for example, that how much should you lay off according to whether your target was moving or stationary, and things of this kind. Even when we were practicing small bore with primary armament, we used to sit in a great big cage which was rocked while you were actually firing, so that you had no experience of how to shoot standing still. This indicates, of course, I presume, a cavalry influence, in the sense that it was assumed always that we would be charging out to meet the enemy. And it was the Germans who taught us that the correct way to do this is to get your own tanks on ground of their own choosing, under cover if possible, in other words, on a hill, or just got the gun peeping over the top, and get the enemy to come towards you. This was an extension, if you like, of the fixed anti-tank gun line that Rommel was the great expert in, whereby the basis of, if you knew that you were going to have to meet an armoured onslaught from the enemy coming at you this way, you found a bit of ground that was to your own liking, where you could hide down behind, if you like, and you had a series of anti-tank guns. It didn't have to be tanks. And then your tanks came out and sort of, so to speak, encouraged the enemy to come on forward, you see, into an increasingly favorable range, and then the anti-tank guns sitting on their bottoms quietly and dug in and out of sight had you dead cold. And Montgomery was the first one to copy this with Alan Halfa. That was before Alamein. And from then on, this charging about the countryside stopped, because it was bloody murder. We used to get seen off by these gun lines.
You mentioned earlier on that
that's beyond your terms of reference, I'm afraid.
You mentioned that there were a few exceptions. Do you remember any at all?
Well, look, obviously, if you got caught in a difficult position, and to move would have meant certainly you'd have got blown to sky high, you'd get under cover and have a go at the chap standing still, wouldn't you? But this wasn't, strictly speaking, in the book. So not strictly speaking, the book.
In those first exercises, 32, what was your job? Do you recall?
Me personally?
Yes.
I was half troops. I was second in command of a troop of cardinaloids.
And what were you doing?
Well, in all of these exercises, our job was to protect the heavy tanks. So you might have a formation of heavy tanks behind you in some way like this, and they would be covered by the light tanks, so that if the enemy appeared anywhere, they would be immediately warned what was happening.
And did you find the cardinaloids were effective for this job?
Oh no, only as a training vehicle. only in that they represented something which we knew one day would be a tank. I mean, you can't say they would be effective in any other way. Maneuvers-wise, they're effective because we were able to spread out, we could go faster, and we were very low silhouette and all the rest of it. They were relatively effective for the training job we did with them, but obviously were not suitable for what they would have had to do in war.
And you were aware of that at the time, were you?
Oh, yes.
What would you say was the main emphasis in those 32 exercises, main objective?
We'll turn that off for a moment.
You would say that the main emphasis was on mobility, would you?
Control, I think, allied with mobility, but above all, control. You've got, after all, you've got 150 odd tanks, you have behind them 100 at least B vehicles and so on. You are assuming that you're going to advance into enemy territory and so on and so forth. You've got to learn, and yourself, the bosses have, and teach those below you exactly how the thing is going to operate.
In those 32 exercises, do you remember any anecdotes about anything that happened during that period?
No, only the one how easy it was to lose your way in the middle of the night in a 4-inch map. So I think we mentioned, didn't we, once?
What happened then?
Well, just to show you the difficulties that could arise, it so happened that I was leading a column of, I forget, about 100 and something tanks and lorries and other things. And in those days, the idea was we should use a 4-inch a 1 mile to 4 inches map, which is quite difficult to read. And in the middle of the night, I dropped my pencil I was marking it with, and by the time I'd found it, I'd overshot the mark, by which time I had a tail behind me, and to turn them around and go back was impossible. I had to take a chance and cut off across country. These sort of things were, I suppose, all part of learning the trade.
And you found your way back, did you?
Yeah, took a chance and took the next road.